This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Welcome to another episode of the One Was Had a Dream podcast. My name is Lee Finch, and as ever, I will be joined by the one and only Danny Baker. We have a very special guest, one I'm very excited to welcome onto the podcast, ex-Wimbledon manager, academy manager, reserve manager, and legend of Wimbledon, Terry Burton. We'll be speaking to him shortly. But first off, let me introduce Danny Baker. How are we, Danny? You good?
Yeah, I'm really good, mate, actually. Yeah, it's been... It's been a really interesting week being a Dons fan, as you know. Obviously, after Saturday, which was really, really hard to sort of watch and take, and particularly some of the reaction of the fans. It's just tough, isn't it? It's also just a weird experience. We've been watching Wimbledon for God knows how long. I was trying to think of how many sort of dead rubber seasons we've had, and we've not had many at all, have we, really? So to have this point where it's kind of there's not a huge amount to play for, there's kind of that every game doesn't quite have that urgency on it. So it's been quite an interesting week talking to some of the guys at work who are obviously Dons fans and some of the kids. But am I buzzing for today? Well done for getting an absolute hero of mine on the pod, and I can't wait to sort of divulge in some of those stories. And I'd love to know at some point whether he was actually a victim of the crazy gang spirit in some way, but I'm sure he will elaborate and keep it clean.
Yeah, I'm quite lucky. I missed the whole weekend of Wimbledon, obviously, because I was...
Yeah, you were away. How was it? Italy, weren't you?
I was in Italy, yeah. I went to see Atalanta versus Udinese on the Saturday. That was heavy boozing because you can drink around the ground, and the Italian fans were brilliant. So we drank a lot of beer. And then on Sunday, I went to the San Siro and went to a dream stadium of mine. The San Siro, ticked off a bucket list. What a state. I recommend it to anyone. It closes now in 2027. I told the missus it closed in the summer, and that's why I had to get out there now before they knocked it down. We found out when we were out there, it doesn't close for another couple of years. And she's like, oh, yeah, you pulled that one, didn't you? You got out there now. But,
well, yeah. I reckon, Lee, we need to ask our guests, where's the best place to watch football? What do you think? Is that a good starter for 10?
I think we're speaking to Terry Burton, Wimbledon legend, hero of many, I know. Terry, how are we? How are you? You good?
Yeah. I'm good, thanks, guys. Yep.
Terry, where's the best place? Come on, you of all your experiences, of all the grounds you've seen, where's the best place to watch football, do you think?
Well, my best place is from a dugout.
Okay. Really.
There's nothing quite like that feeling of being in a dugout.
What is so special about it, Terry? What is it about that dugout which is so different to everything else?
Well, you know, it's the next best thing to playing, really. You're there, you're part of that 90 minutes or plus, however long the match takes nowadays, but you're there, you're a part of it. it's you're still, so you're still really closely involved in the game. So Dagger, you know, and I've been to quite a few. I must admit, I still probably in my time as a coach, because obviously before my 14 years at Wimbledon, I spent a number of years at Arsenal. And when I worked with Don Howe, we were, you know, as it was first division back then. And Anfield always brought a tingle, really. Yeah. Just going to the ground, you know, arriving in the team coach. That was sort of always a special place to sort of watch football. But yeah, I've been around Europe and watched some different games, but I still think the atmosphere in our football in the UK, in the leagues in England, is still, you know, as good as it gets anywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, the supporters, that's what make it. The supporters make it. So it's always been special.
No, I agree. I'd say the only thing I've got with football stadiums nowadays is they're becoming like too commercialised. They're too worried about hospitality. It's like I said, we were in Italy and went to the San Siro, and me and the lads we went with said it's a travesty. They're going to be knocking it down and building a Spurs or a Wembley. Do you know what I mean? Because it's such an iconic, lovely football stadium, where nowadays it's just the same bowl kind of stadium, and it's all new and hasn't got that feeling anymore, I think, with some stadia nowadays. So.
Yeah, the atmosphere. It's the atmosphere that makes it, isn't it, when you go in, as you're right. It could be too sterile sometimes. You know, nice box with heated seats. And who wants that? You want to feel the cold and the wind and the rain. You don't
above all at half time. Yeah. Yes.
So Terry, how did you get into coaching? Obviously, I've looked at your illustrious playing career on Wikipedia. It's a lot more illustrious than I thought it would be. I've seen a few, but I'm just curious as to what of all the things when you stopped playing, what got you focused into your coaching, well, and why?
It was circumstances, really, Dan. It was I'd been at Arsenal since the age of 12 and through to sort of just about 19, got released. Could have signed for a couple of, I could have gone at Peterborough at the time and signed there, but I was a London boy. I just got engaged, and I'd been an Arsenal supporter and an Arsenal fan and been there all my sort of youth, really. And it knocked me back, as it does a lot of young kids when they get released. So I stopped. That was it. I stopped playing for a little while. And I still probably, maybe it's just time, but somebody had said to me about coaching. And that was, so I went and did my prelim badge when I was sort of nearly 20, 19 and a half. I met a guy there called Roger Thompson, who was one of the FA coaches, took me through the prelim badge, but also got me back playing. So he invited me back, and I'd stopped playing completely. And so I went back and played at Epping with him, and loved it, and got the Player of the Year and stuff like that. He went
Go
to
on, Hayes. Hell. Player of the Year.
Yes.
Had to happen sometime. And but yeah, so went to Hayes with him and really enjoyed that. But during that time, I did my coaching badge, and then I sort of was working at every level. I was working at school, in the schools. I was working evening institutes, taking like kids during the day, men during the evenings. Just loved it. Became player coach at Ilford quite early when I was about 22. And then got a real massive opportunity to go to Arsenal as coach the schoolboys. And I was sort of 23, so I was player coach at Ilford at that age, to coaching the schoolboys at Arsenal. And then, you know, a man called Bertie Mee, who was manager there, he was there, manager. Full-time.
And what was it like? I mean, I've been looking through, and you mentioned him earlier, Don Howe, who's got a huge link, obviously, with us in 88.
Yeah.
From what I can see by the timeline, did you work with him at Arsenal and then Wimbledon, or was it Arsenal? And I'm just curious as to where that link is.
It was Arsenal first. It was so... Again, I went in full-time at Arsenal in about 77, 78, and did the youth team, worked the youth team, did the reserve teams as they were back then. And Don was assistant manager working with Terry Neill. Terry Neill got the sack, Don got the job, and he moved me up with him for 18 months. So I had I had 18 months, fantastic months.
He was phenomenal, Don Howe, wasn't he?
He was exceptional.
Yeah.
Really, really exceptional coach. So I was very fortunate in my early career. So I was still late 20s, sort of just turning 30, and got the opportunity to work with him, which
What was he so good about, Terry? What was so good about Don Howe?
I think that his knowledge, he knew the game inside out, but his manner, he had a great manner. He just could get players to react, and his coaching sessions were fantastic. And I was fortunate; I was young enough then to still join in quite a lot of them. So, which I did. So it was just, he had his great manner about him, where he could be sort of really hard and get at players, but also they knew that he knew what he was talking about, so they responded.
Terry, what was the difference with then and now between coaches? Because there's not as many, say, English-British coaches, where back in your day, there would have been loads. Joe Kinnear, for me, was loved Joe Kinnear massively. I know we're going to talk about you working with him. You said Don Revy, you had Don Revy, you had Clough. What's the difference that we've only really got, if you look at the Premier League now, you only got Eddie Howe and Dyche at Everton. There's not as many British and English coaches. But back in the day, there was so many throughout the leagues. Ferguson, do you know what I mean? And as I said, Joe Kinnear. What's the difference then and now, do you believe?
Opportunity, really. It's the game's changed, hasn't it? And the finances in the game have become far greater. So, you know, the opportunity for foreign coaches to come in, and I think there is always been that little bit of perception. Even I remember when I was manager at Wimbledon, sort of, you know, early my 2001. I think there was just that starting to come into the game, the foreign managers, and there was disgruntled some of us English coaches that a lot more were coming into game. Opportunities become less. And in fact, I did a after game chat. When I was at Selhurst with the press, and I pretended to do it in French.
Like Steve McLaren, yeah.
Tony White was there at the time, who spoke French, and he was the press liaison guy, and he came in with me. So, bonjour, you know, it was sort of one of those. So I was half taking the mickey, but just trying to get a point over, really.
So we were talking about your time at Arsenal, and then obviously you moved to Wimbledon. How did that come about that you got? Because it was reserve team manager that you came in first off. Was that correct?
So it was through Bobby Gould and Don Howe. So Bobby had been a player at the Arsenal when I was there as a youngster.
Oh, right. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so Bobby was there. So I knew him from that and really, you know, got on well and liked him. Don obviously had been my mentor anyway. And I'd got the sack at Arsenal by George Graham.
Never liked him.
Yeah, it was my fault, because I thought I was the golden boy and I bought all these players that had come through Arsenal. I mean, Man United talk about their 90, 91, 92 group, but we had a group at 81, 82 at Arsenal that were, you know, Tony Adams, Martin Keown, David Rowcastle, David Thomas.
Wow.
Mickey Thomas, sorry. Martin.
That's serious.
You there were so many kids that come through that time and played first team football. So I sort of thought I was untouchable because I'd worked with virtually all of them at some level. But I didn't really get on with George at the time. I got on really well with him when he was a player, and I got on with him since. But, you know, it's tough being a manager, and I didn't really appreciate that at the time. So I wasn't the best reserve team coach for him. So we parted company. A year later, Wimbledon won the FA Cup in 88, and that's when I came into the club.
So you came in after the FA Cup final?
Yeah, I came in just... I knew I was getting the job because Bobby told me the January of that year, look, in the summer, that they applied to get into what was then the football combination.
That's right.
And if they got in, they got in, so I became the reserve team manager that year.
And what was Bobby like, Terry? Because obviously that group is really interesting, and we hear all about the vitriol of the FA Cup and the stories about, you know, taking them for haircuts
in the day,
going for a pint the night before and stuff. How important was Bobby Gould's attitude to the team? Because the team is obviously, it's got its reputation. I'm just curious as to how important you think Bobby was in that, or was Bobby just a stalwart to what can be described as a unique set of players?
Well, I think you're right on both counts, really. They were a unique set of players. I think where the club were either very lucky or Sam was very smart in getting Bobby in, was that Bobby wasn't going to change things. He wasn't going to go and look to, you know, create a new model of Wimbledon. He was going to play to the players' strengths. And he was very, very clever and bringing Don in with him. So you had this guy who had a, you know, Bobby was a great character, still is a great character.
Yeah, lovely guy.
And you know, a good football man, knew his football, had a great eye for a player. But you had Don Howe, who was tactically probably a genius. So you had a great two people that were both good football people, where Bobby kept the mentality of the crazy gang. He kept it going.
I'm really fascinated, Terry. And forgive me for being honest, I don't know much about your sort of footballing philosophy, but it must be quite interesting. You've come from Arsenal, who I presume play quite a lot of get the ball down and play some good football, and then you've come to Wimbledon. How did that marry up with you? Because obviously you've got, it's not a rags to riches, and like I said, I'm never going to big up one or the other, but it's quite an interesting dynamic. You're going to come in from a totally different world to a football team who are, less in terms of, you know, Brian Clough, aren't playing football. How does that marry up with your head, and how do you kind of get your head around how to move forward with it?
Yeah, I think you're right. It was very different. I come from the Marble Halls.
Yeah,
and I came to the Porter Cabins at Plough Lane. You know, it was totally different, and I wasn't sure how to, you know, what to expect to start with. But the fact that Bobby Gould and Don Howe were there, you knew that this place had to be something special. So the football philosophy part of it, Bobby said to me, "I want you to teach the players how to play football."
Oh, right. Okay, that's interesting.
So I said, you don't want me to sort of follow on the theme of and the philosophy of the of how the first thing. He said, no. He said, because evolution will take place and gradually that will change, you know. So he just said, teach him how to play football. So it was great, you know. I'm just trying to think back. You know, Sullivan was in there and Dean Blackwell and John Gannon and Ian Hazel, Sawyer, and people like that had all been around that crazy gang group. But they came in, and I think we finished third that season in the football comp, which for our first season. And I think they enjoyed playing a different way. In fact, I think it was Laurie Sanchez who used to, you know, again, a good football man, Laurie, but he'd go in and watch some of the games, and apparently Bobby told me, when I knocked on Bobby's door one day, he said, look, what's going on here? He said, they're playing football to the reserves. They're passing it and they're doing, they're not playing like we play. You know, he said, do you think that's right? So there was a little bit of worry that these players wouldn't be able to go and transfer from reserve team football into first team football and play the Wimbledon way, if you like. But they could. They'd been brought up on that. They knew how to play that.
When it started evolving, and as you said, we started playing football and stuff, did the club, like yourself and the managers there, did they ever get annoyed with the press and some of the stuff that was coming out of the press, that we were just a long ball team? Do you know what I mean? We had players who couldn't play, like Vinnie Jones was just a man who would go out and beat people up. John Fashanu was the same. But we had, if you're a Wimbledon fan and you're obviously amongst it, you actually know that these players can play. And if you look, I'm not saying we were Liverpool of now, but Liverpool play, they try and get it into the first. They get players up the pitch quickly. Like Robinson's more of a left winger than a left back. And yeah, we got absolutely killed in the press a lot of the time. And people like Gary Lineker gave us stick. Did that ever annoy you in the background, saying, well, actually, we're teaching these players how to play football. They actually can play it, but we're not getting the credit that we deserve.
Yeah, and I think over a period of time, you know, the club, I mean, they played to their strengths, don't get me wrong. You know, when Dave Bassett was there, and it was probably, you know, slightly more direct, and then Bobby and Don come in and just tinkered with it to a degree, and changed some things about it, but not much, because it was a successful formula. But then you gradually, new players came in, and you think about the quality of the players that actually went from Wimbledon to other clubs.
Yeah,
you know, fantastic turnover of players. Now those clubs wouldn't have taken those players unless they could play. So you're right. It was a bit frustrating, but did it really matter to us? No, not really. You know, I think the players got other clubs appreciated what they could do.
I'm just curious, Terry. Obviously, Heysel came and obviously we couldn't play European football. From your angle, if you were obviously at the club, how do you think Wimbledon would have been received by the European football community? Do you think we would have we'd have done all right? We'd have ruffled a few feathers? Or do you feel like, do you know what, the game on the continent might have swallowed us up a bit? I'm just curious as to where you think we might have sat around that time.
Yeah, I think Wimbledon would have done fantastically well because, you know, it doesn't matter. There was never any fear about where they went to play. You know, the opposition normally had a bit of fear about them coming. And I think that would have been the same in Europe. It would have, you know, I don't think anybody would have sort of been looking forward to Wimbledon going and playing there. Just out of reputation as much as anything else.
The thought of Vinnie Jones and John Fashanu going down the Champs-Élysées with a ghetto blaster is terrifying. Yeah. Well, I can imagine all those boys in Monaco by the casinos looking smart. That it's sort of, I could just see them walking down the road, cutting people's tyres. And
they would have loved doing it as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Terry, we had Andy Brazil on, who's a European football expert, big Wimbledon fan as well. He works at Talk Sport. And I said to Danny and him, I said, I think we would have shook a lot of teams up. I think we would have gone to the San Siro with a big ghetto blaster. And I think other teams, the Italian teams, the Spanish teams would have looked and gone, bloody hell, who are these? We're going to walk over them. And then they would have got a bit of a shock. And I think we'd have done all right in Europe with some of the players. And the fact that we were mixing up the football that we could play as well.
Yeah, because I think it was that year, wasn't it, when we finished sixth, that we would have been entitled to go into it had it not been for, you know, the disasters that happened. So.
Yeah,
but don't worry though. We had our Intertoto Cup expedition down at the Goldstone. We remember that very well.
We did, yes, yeah.
I was just going to ask Terry about the whole crazy gang identity. A lot of the things when I was younger and dad was like, you know, my dad was like, you can pick your wife, you can pick your mates, but we support Wimbledon and we're going now. And I remember going along the road and him telling me about Wimbledon and going with my brother. I went in the, I think I started going 87. So I'm only just 21 now. But I'm just curious as to whether you think that the crazy gang identity, do you think it added to us as a club? And did you, as a management, was it something that we were happy to keep, or were we trying to get away from that as you went on through the years? Obviously, by the time we got to the end, the crazy gang kind of culture, it almost became the circus of the Egil Olsen circus to a point at the end. Did we try and get rid of that kind of culture, or was it always something like, do you know what, this is part of our DNA, we're going to run with it, we'll play along with it, and we'll sort of slowly evolve the footballing aspect of it?
Yeah, it's more the latter part of it. I think that, you know, big, and it was the evolution. Players came in that were different. You know, when you think of the, you know, Terry Phelan's and John Scales and Keith Curls and Robbie Earls and Warren Barton's, Dean Oldsworth's, you know, who came in probably outside that era of the crazy gang, but fitted in fantastically well. And I think they appreciated what had happened beforehand and the strength and the camaraderie, but also had different technical abilities that were probably different from those other players. So gradual evolution was of the players who would play. And probably the biggest mistake was the Egil Olsen era of trying to change everything and to say, well, we want to be different now. Well, you can't be different overnight. And that was where the mistake probably happened.
Terry, so you were reserve team manager and then you become academy manager before coming Joe Kinnear's assistant. That's correct, yeah? So how long was you, if people didn't know, how long was you academy manager for?
So I was there 88. I think I had about sort of 18 months doing the reserve team. And Bobby again said to me, look, he said, and Wimbledon had created quite a lot of their own ground players anyway, but he just said, look, we want to try and produce more. We want to try and get more through. So would you have a look at it and try and revamp it? And that, you know,
was that appealing to you, Terry?
Yeah, because
it could easily be seen as a step back, but it's not really.
No, because youth development for me had been what I'd always loved. You know, that was a big part of my time at Arsenal. Howard Wilkinson had just started this the new academy set up, etc. So there was a lot going on at that level. And I loved it, you know, and we had a really good team of people there. Ernie Tippett, who was youth team coach in my time there, and Roger Smith, who was the recruitment guy, and some other really good top people around that. And it was just a great place to work. And we had a good group of young players, but we really punched above our weight. You know, we started to get development centres in other parts of London. So the Joby McEnuffs and the Patrick Adjamans and the Lionel Morgans all came from North London.
Yeah.
You know, whereas a lot of other, it was only the big clubs that were actually doing that at the time, but we had this vision that we could actually get pockets around London and then bring the kids into this Wimbledon culture, which we did quite successfully.
I was going to say, one of the big successful things for me is our youth, because when I started watching Wimbledon, we had the John Fashions and stuff like that, but we also had then the, as you said, Dean Blackwell's, the Chris Perrys, Neil Sullivan's coming
Jason
through,
Yule, Cole
Jason
Court,
Yule, Cole Court, and then we had, and then it's one thing that we've now started doing at AFC Wimbledon, where we have got some good youth team, we've sold a sow, and that's one good thing that I like, that I look at Wimbledon FC and AFC Wimbledon that we're doing really well at. Who would you say, if you could pick one?
That's my best question, was that?
Was the best, because you mentioned one there that I think would have gone on and been an absolute star, is Lionel Morgan. Unfortunately, we obviously know he suffered with a bad injury, but when he came on against Liverpool and absolutely destroyed that Liverpool team that time in about 20 minutes, well, I just thought, wow, this player, this geezer is unreal. Who would you say that, I know, because there's so many you could pick, but for me, who would it be that you would say, right, that's one I'm really proud that we got through and he'd done well?
Yeah, I think coming, when my first period at the club with the youth setup was two players, really, Chris Perry and Neil Ardley.
Yeah.
Now, Chris Perry, because with the position he played centre-back, he was built like a fag paper. You know, 5'9".
Looks like a knick-knack, yeah.
He couldn't sprint. He couldn't do long distance. But this kid just had a great understanding of the game. And anybody that trained with him and all that, he was like a rash.
He was unbelievable, Terry. Watching him, honestly, we were just talking the other day and I was like, I still don't really know why he never really got an England gig.
I was just
when
about
he was at Wimbledon,
say,
he was so good.
I was just about to say the two
whether
of them.
He couldn't pass well enough, I don't know. Chris but Perry, my God, he was brilliant.
I think
that
Chris Perry
one of the qualities that he probably, you know, you couldn't sort of say was a great passer, but he was efficient. He could get it from A to B, but he's defending, and that's what his job was, and that's what he loved doing. You couldn't get a shot away. You couldn't win a header against him. I remember when we played Everton once, and Duncan Ferguson played up front.
I remember it, yeah.
And our two centre-backs were Chris Perry and Brian McAllister. Chris
Brian
Perry
McAllister
was like 5'9", and Brian McAllister probably about 5'10", 5'11". But Ferguson couldn't win a header. They keep working and they keep pushing him up, dropping off. He didn't know whether to stick or twist Ferguson. These two, and they'd mark him in the box, they'd grab him, they'd hold him, make sure he couldn't get a free header. They were just so intelligent. And that was what people didn't appreciate about that group of players, you know, from the Andy Thorns, people like that. So intelligent defender, Wally Downs, really, really good, intelligent defenders that knew the job and could stop people playing. And the kids that followed on after that, like the McAllisters and the Chris Perrys as defenders, Dean Blackwell's did exactly the same. They were excellent defenders. So I would say Chris Perry defensively, I think Neil Ardley as a creative player. Again, you look at Neil Ardley, didn't have blistering pace, playing as a wide player, but had fantastic
cross,
delivery.
Couldn't he? Crikey.
Great delivery, good understanding of the game, good work ethic. So he had a lot of the good qualities that would be relevant today even, you know, because he could still play with his knowledge of the game. So he had a great knowledge of the game. So that period, those two. And then you mentioned one a while ago called Lionel Morgan. Again,
how good was he, Terry?
You know, we were away at Millwall and somebody got injured in about the first 15 minutes. So Lionel was on the bench, said, "Lionel, come on in." And he'd been playing as a wide player normally. So he was 17. Come on. He played centre of the park away at Millwall and he just grew. You could just see this figure. He was a nice size, but he went on the pitch. He looked about 7 foot tall. and he controlled the game again. He played centre of the park. He won tackles. He got the ball. He brought people into the game. I think he would have been an exceptional, exceptional player.
Yeah, I agree. I think he would have been, gone to really big thing. I feel sorry for Neil Ardley as well for playing for England, because if you look at that right side that England had at the time that Neil Ardley come through, you had the Beckhams and things like that. So I think he was, he possibly should have got an England cap. But when you look, again, with Chris Perry, and you look at the players he had to come back across, we had a really good lot of centre-backs at England as well. Terry, with the difference, as you said now, football's evolved so much. And you look at youth teams now, like Chelsea have got like 250 kids in their academy, where when we were Wimbledon FC, as you said, we went up to North London and stuff like that. We used to take the boys that have been released. That doesn't really happen nowadays because they're not getting released until they're late on. Do you think that was a big thing that we had, that say Palace would release a player and we'd go, look, come for Wimbledon, we have this pathway into the first team, and that's why we got so many come through?
Yeah, I think there was the pathway. I think there was still this the creating of Wimbledon. They still had a mentality there that when players came in, they quickly adjusted, or they even went back out again. We weren't given enough credit for how successful that academy was, really.
Yeah,
and the amount of players that the youth team and the youth setup produced through to the first team. I think even in my 2 years as manager, there was like, I think it was something like 14 players got their debuts. Now, they weren't all gone on to be established household names, but they got an opportunity. So the point you made about a pathway is vitally important. And it's still today, you look at clubs and you go, good pathway, bad pathway.
Yeah.
So you're looking at those clubs now with academies, and you're thinking, why would you send your kid there to play? Because he won't play. He won't never play for their first team.
It's
a problem in the game.
I think that's the point as well. We didn't get enough credit. And it's not just the players that ended up playing for Wimbledon. There was a lot of players that would go off and they end up playing good professional careers at other clubs. I think, who is it? Lenny, the two brothers,
Lenny Piper.
Lenny Piper.
He was one of my favourites when I was younger.
He ended up having a decent career, played a decent level at non-league as well. He ended up coming up against us when we were AFC Wimbledon, I think, for Fisher Athletic called Dulwich, I think, at the time. Yeah. So I think that's...
But there was, a group of young players who came in at debuts, even people like Rob Gere, Peter Hawkins, come in and played. Ansar Owusu, unfortunately, who died not so long ago, that got games in that first team. Many others, that played in there but weren't household names, but they got an opportunity to play at our club.
It always blew my mind a bit with some players, because as Danny said, with the crazy gang spirit, and you said they either sank or swim, but then you'd mentioned Rob Gere, Peter Hawkins, but they were the nicest people. I met them a couple of times. They signed my shirts and stuff when I was, and you think, how are they playing in a crazy gang, like getting their suits burnt? But when you meet like Chris Perry's one of the nicest people you could have ever spoke to or meet, very intelligent man. But once they go on the football pitch, I'm guessing the mentality just changed, and that was just drummed into them.
Yeah, they were, Jason Yule and Carl Coote, they were never, weren't going to be troublemakers, but they could come in and be part of it in their own way, with their own personality, you're right. These kids would come in, and I think they all appreciated what was going on, and they took a lot of the good bits from it.
Yeah.
I can remember the Stanley Reid, God bless him, he was a fantastic character and a massive part of that club and the mentality. In the Richardson Evans, in those old change rooms, would come in at the end of every youth game. I go, come on in, boys, here we go. Let's all sing. And it would be la-di-da-di-da. And the kids loved that. It created something different, which a lot of other clubs didn't have.
I'm just curious, Terry, in terms of we've basically racked off a whole host of unbelievable football players who could have quite easily potentially got close to international recognition. Do you feel a lot of the players who left Wimbledon left because of the need to sell? Or do you feel that a lot of players thought, you know what, I'm never going to get a call up for England? Because it just looked ridiculous. The amount of times Warren Barton never got a look in England, Wimbledon. He left within a week. He was in the England squad when he was at Newcastle. Mm-hmm. You can say the same about John Scales. There was a whole host of Neil. I mean, luckily we had Neil Sullivan, who obviously was doing Scotland. But it just came to me that it looked like it was almost a closed shop. Did it feel like that to the players? And did it have an impact on retention or not really?
I think there was a stigma, wasn't there, around that, they're Wimbledon, they only play a certain way. You know, we've talked about it. And unfortunately, I think there was a lot of that, you know, that they couldn't possibly be England material. But, you know, all the top clubs wanted to actually bring these players to their clubs. So I think the clubs, there's a shelf life. They love the time at the club. But like all people, you know, they want to be the best they can be. And, you know, it was a move to the next level, which would help them to achieve either financially what they wanted to get or international recognition.
So I just wanted to talk, we're obviously going like a timeline. I wanted to touch on a different subject in terms of the start of the rumours around the club moving. And obviously you had, I remember one of the headlines about linking us with QPR. It was like Quimbledon, and they had the, we're going to go to Wales, we're going to go to Norway, we're going to go to Ireland. Mm. I mean, how did that go down with the group? And at what point did it kind of feel like, okay, hold on a minute, this might have the point that the thought of a relocation might have a little bit of legs in it? Is there any kind of point you thought, hold on a minute, this actually has got something in it?
I think the first one was the Dublin one.
Yeah.
When Sam, you know, had this idea of going to Dublin. And I think all the players thought they were going to be tax exiles, so they sort of weren't.
Did he speak to you about it, Terry? Did he say, Terry, we're thinking of going to Dublin? What are you thinking? Or
Well, not really, because, you know, I don't think we would have had a say in it. I think it was a purely financial aspect. It wasn't from a football point of view. Yeah. But, you know, some of the points that were put over were quite valid. You know, look, we could go there, we'll be a Premier League team in Dublin. We'll get X amount of 1,000 supporters. Our supporters, you know, we'll make sure we can get them over. So Sam sort of tried to have a plan of how that might work. But so there was talk around that one, and that was the one that, you know, seemed, oh, maybe.
Yeah.
Once Sam left, there was the obvious that the QPR talk.
Yeah. How viable was that? A real option on the table, or was it kind of a throwaway?
I don't know, really. You know, a lot of it was, you got the mushroom treatment, really. You were put in the cupboard and kept in the dark and, you know, fed a lot of crap. But
fair enough.
The Milton Keynes thing was, you know, it was an obvious thing that they were intent on happening. And there was more meetings that went on about that. And that was when you started to think, you know, this could happen. I personally never thought it would happen, because I thought, how could the FA allow that to happen and allow a team to be moved out of their conurbation area into, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles away? But at the time, there was lots of conversations going on, lots of meetings with Pete Winkleman up there. So, and in my second season there, it became more of a reality.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, listen, the rift had started, you know.
Of course, absolutely, yeah.
But the rift between myself and the owners and the so-called chief executives who were running the club at the time.
And how were the players feeling, Terry? Sorry, Lee, I'm just going to cut you for a sec. I'm not trying to do anything difficult. I'm just curious. So they're getting an idea that they're being relocated. I guess for the players, it's not hugely important, because players move all the time, I get. But is there kind of a growing theme like, okay, hold on, we might actually need to, we're at Wimbledon, but we're going to be moving here and there's things that need to be moving. Was it quite a difficult one for the players? Or was it a case of, do you know what, we're going to keep our head down, business as usual, and we'll get on with it?
To be truthful, Dan, I can't really remember a conversation the players having about it. Maybe they did their sales, because there was still this, it wasn't a reality. It was like, this is something that people, you know, as you say, there've been lots of conversations about Wimbledon going somewhere in the past. and would happen again maybe at some time, but it never happened. So I think the players thought, look, this is just background noise and, you know, it's never going to happen. So I don't think they took it too seriously.
So is it because we kind of skipped? We'll come back to your career.
Yeah, I kind of was talking about before of Egil, but I'll come back to that.
We'll come back to Jarrow and Egil in a minute. But as we're discussing, we've heard rumours that did it cost you your job that you went to them and said you weren't overly happy with the move that was going to happen? Obviously, we'd been relegated and you weren't happy and you voiced your concerns about the move to Milton Keynes and it kind of cost your job. And then they brought in Stuart Murdoch, who then went to Milton Keynes with Wimbledon and ruined every reputation.
Wasn't he the goalkeeping lad, Stuart Murdoch?
He was goalkeeping coach.
Yeah, I remember goalkeeping coach. Yeah,
he sat
with
us at Southampton when we just got relegated. He was in the bar with us. And shame.
There's a lot of things that went on during the ownership, the new ownership, the Norwegians, and the chairman there, Charles Koppel, and his sidekick. Can't remember his name, but there was
best
a lot
not to remember that.
There's a lot of things that went on that I didn't like that weren't really, they weren't football people, you know, they just weren't football people. They didn't understand it. And then there was the big issues really were the one going to Milton Keynes, which, and I during that year, probably that year when I got the sack, I had a burst appendix, and I was in hospital, and I don't know whether it was the drugs or whatever, but I was formulating this plan that when I went out to try to go to the owners and convince them that we had to get rid of Koppel, we had to get him out, and we had to go back to the supporters, and we had to, because they were the only ones that were going to, you know, keep us wherever we were, and formulate a plan with the supporters, get them on side. Because as you know, that last year, the atmosphere was toxic.
Horrendous. Yeah,
and it wasn't the best atmosphere to play in home games. If you looked at our away form that second year, you know, we beat Man City. I was there
4-0. Yeah, 4-0. Two Shipley, two Connolly. Yeah,
yeah, and you know, we had loads and great results away from home, but at home we just
beat Wolves at Molineux as well, I think.
Yeah, beat Wolves. Yeah, yeah.
So,
you know, we were excellent away from home, but so that did have a. So I was in this hospital bed, probably delirious from the drugs or something, but formulating this plan that when I went out, I was going to go and see the owners. Got to get rid of Koppel, get him out. He's toxic. The supporters will never have him. Change the way that we're talking about the club. And I had one brief conversation with the owners, but it was obvious that was never going to happen. And I knew my days were sort of numbered, really.
Because I'm glad you mentioned Norwich. I've always wondered if they look back now, and I know they kicked themselves looking at how football has gone. Because when they came in, we were probably one of the richest clubs in the Premier League at that time. Because I think they spent 30 million on a racing boat that they crashed. And I was thinking, these guys are like, we bought John Artson for 7.5 million and stuff like that. And I was thinking, do they actually regret what they've done and think, well, actually, if we had gone and got the ground in Plough Lane now, and I'm glad we did, I'm love AFC Wimbledon and everything about it. But I do think sometimes they think with all these billionaire owners and the money they had, do they actually think, I wish we had done, you know what I mean, put a bit more money and effort into it and not
being because the plan, you know, when I got the job in that summer of 2000, their brochure was different. You know, they wanted to build a stadium somewhere in Merton. They wanted to do what we're doing, produce our own players. They wanted then to build the club, et cetera, et cetera. So they had this, they talked a good game at the time, but... Unfortunately, as it went on, they lost a bit of interest, but they certainly gave too much to control to Charles Koppel.
So before I'm really fascinated with Egil Olsen, and I thought at the time he'd be a great appointment, but I've just got to ask you, Terry, and I'll be really honest. We had Bobby Gould, we had Ray Harford, Peter Wiv, Joe Kinnear, Egil Olsen, and then you. You was really loyal for a long old time. Was there any Did you apply before the time that you were given the job? Did you ever apply for one of the Wimbledon jobs before? I'm just curious because, you know, you're an absolute legend for us, and you've got your whole career. You're obviously a fantastic coach, but the opportunities to manage have been quite limited. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think in the era of you know, those managers, if you like, take Egil Olsen out of that. You know, you mentioned Bobby Gould had been a top player.
Yeah.
Joe Kinnear had been a top player. Ray Harford had been a good player.
Yeah.
So it was until Mourinho came in, you were probably, you'd had to have been, had, you know, 250 games under your belt, 300 games at the top level to get a manager's job, you know.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's entirely different. You know, it's probably the opposite. And I love what I was doing. You know, I was happy.
Did you have ambitions to be a manager somewhere, Terry?
I'd never really. I did to a degree, but not something that I was going to, you know, which I did in my later career, move different parts of the country. You know, I was a London boy. All my jobs have been around London. And that's where I was going to stay. And I was happy at Wimbledon. And, you know, I loved it. It was a great time to be there. You know, some great moments. So I was quite happy. I was happy doing the academy. You know, loved it. I didn't even at that time. You know, I only came back. You know, I was academy manager when Egil Olsen got the sack, or even before Egil Olsen got the sack, I was still academy manager. And then I got asked by the owners to come in and help him and Lars, his assistant, and Mickey Arford, who was still working there, to come in and work with them. But that was like, you know, I think it was the week before we went away and played at Bradford. And to be fair, I had plans. I was going off to Israel at the time to see a UEFA tournament to look at players. So,
oh wow!
Really and truly, it was only the fact. Really, do I have to? You should.
Yeah, I am. You're twisting my arm.
I've got my own job to do here. But the club were in free fall. You know, I think we'd lost.
Yeah,
however
horrendous.
Many
yeah.
We'd lost them.
The Bradford game was a killer, wasn't it?
If I could help, I wanted to help. You know, obviously. So.
Before we move on to Eagle and Bradford and stuff, because there's a couple of questions around Bradford we probably want, both me and Danny want to ask. Let's talk about Joe Kinnear, because you came in as an assistant manager under Joe. What was Joe like? Because Joe's my favourite ever Wimbledon manager, even the AFC Wimbledon. I love Joe Kinnear. I loved the passion.
He was a perfect match, wasn't he?
Gutted for him when he went to Newcastle, because I think he would have done stuff there if he hadn't got ill, and he was just brilliant. Yeah, he was a Wimbledon man, and everything that Wimbledon wanted was Joe Kinnear, really.
Joe was he's a character, fantastic character, because I was there and Joe, he did the reserves and I was doing the youth team, and Joe, to his own admission, was not what you'd call a coach. So Joe was a fantastic, I thought, man manager, unbelievable man manager. But doing the reserve team, you got to work with the players, and that wasn't, Joe didn't really want to do that. He wanted to be a manager. And, you know, so I was youth team coach. He was reserve team coach. And for quite a period of time, I'd pick him up on the way through and drive him in and stuff, because he'd been away somewhere. And I remember the days we got a phone call from Sam, you know, to say that he was changing. I think it was it Withy that had been there? I think it was Peter Withy.
Yeah.
That he was letting him go. And so we went to Sam's house on the Sunday morning, and Sam said, look, you know, I want you both to take the team, and Joe's manager, you'll be his assistant. And that was it. That was it. We started and off we went, you know.
Did your philosophies match much, Terry? Did you kind of, were you quite chalk and cheese, or were you quite, I mean, obviously he's a manager. Did he kind of go, Terry, you go and coach him and I'll manage the players? What was your rapport between the two of you?
Yeah, it was pretty much that, you know, Joe knew what the club was about. I mean, he was really bright in terms of what players reacted to and responded to. And he had great lines, Joe. He could put them down and he could talk about his career, you know, and FA Cup medals and international caps and stuff like that, which suited the players, you know. So he had that element to him. But on probably Monday to Friday, he'd just say to me, go and, you know. Yeah. And there wasn't, you know, if you'd have said to me, would this work? And I remember the morning, you know, when it happened, and I said to my wife, oh, I'm not sure about this, you know, I'm not sure that this is really going to work, you know. But I'd give it a go. And we did. And we got on all right. You know, we were reasonably, not buddy buddies, but good.
Yeah,
I think
partnership.
We appreciated each other. Yeah. We knew what we were about. And, you know, Joe was a fantastic character. And I think you mentioned it there, was ideal for Wimbledon.
Yeah. It's great. Great marriage. You guys as a partnership look great. From when we were watching it, it kind of seemed exactly what you said was kind of what we as fans were looking at. It just seemed to be like almost like you were the brains of the operation tactically, and he would come in and do the press and do the bravado and the 3 points in the pocket as he's walking off. It just seemed to be
it was such a great one.
It was, you know, I've not really come up to too many characters like him beforehand or since, really, because Joe, he was special. Really special in the way that he managed those players, and probably at another club it wouldn't have worked as well, but at Wimbledon it worked because they loved him as well. To be truthful, they loved him.
So unfortunately, Joe gets ill, and then we get Igor Olsen in charge. And what was your first feeling with Igor? Because me and Danny, we mentioned it last week on the podcast.
We were well excited.
We were, because he said there's only two clubs or two teams he'd managed, which was one was Brazil and the next was Wimbledon. And if you look at Igor Olsen now and you look at some of the footballers played, he was probably before his time, the zonal marking and stuff. And to be fair to him, he brought in some Norwegian players who were really, really good.
Only 400 of them, yeah.
Some of them were not very good. But what did you think when he first came? Did you meet him and go through stuff with him? Or because his wellies and stuff like that.
This is my first. So, you know, Eggles coming in, but hadn't got there yet. It was summer. It was that summer. And everyone else has sort of gone. And the pitches at Richardson Evans were poor in the best of times, but we'd had a really hot summer or something like that. So I've gone out close about a week before we're due back pre-season and looked at the pitches, and they were awful. So apparently, anyway, Sam's come down in the afternoon along with Egil Olsen. They've looked at the pitch, and then Sam's phoned me. What the fuck, you know, what's going on, baby? Look at these pitches. They're useless. They're awful. So I said, Sam, I told you this like weeks ago about these pitches, that they're not fit for purpose.
I'm also not a groundsman.
I'm not in charge of this club. I said, I'm the academy manager. I said, so, you know, that's somebody else's job, not mine. So Egil come in, and I thought he would do well, same as you guys, because he's the way that he wanted to play was very similar, you know.
100%.
But what he didn't have was he didn't have the character that was needed really for that group of players, because as much as you could a style of play, it was also about that empathy with that group of players about what they were about, and you could get more out of them with a character like Joe than you could with someone like Egil. But the early signs were decent, you know.
Yeah, then, won 3-2 at Watford, didn't we? First game of the season. Was it 3-2 we won? I think it was.
And the pre-season friendlies I watched, and I thought, oh, this is okay. It'd do all right. But of course, he didn't have that Monday. He didn't have that sort of Monday to Friday mentality about how to get the best out of the players, either in training or how to make them react on a Saturday in terms of their attitude and spirit. And they lost that. That's what they lost, really. They lost the attitude and spirit, which had won them probably more games than their technical or tactical ability.
So do you think it's to do with some of the players as well, some of their attitudes towards him, that with the stuff in the press, with the wellies and the stuff like that, that got more attention than, say, his managerial career or what he could do, and some of the players didn't really buy into it, then that way they then kind of didn't have any respect for him, because there was rumours going around that some of the players would finish training, go straight down the pub, eat what they want, drink what they want, and just didn't really... Where Wenger came in, all the Arsenal players got on board with it straight away, and they were like, right, this is the... And he changed the whole club, with Wimbledon, it was like, no, we're still the crazy gang. It don't matter what you're going to do.
Yeah, I think there was loads of that, really, Lee. That you know, the boys wanted, they wanted a leader. They wanted motivation. But Eggle, I remember Eggle saying, oh, it's not my job to motivate them. You know? And so the change was too brutal from Joe to Eggle was too brutal. You know, if there had been a couple of stages in between, maybe it wouldn't have been as such a disaster. But it was a disaster.
I mean, there was a couple of, I don't know when you started getting the red flags popped up, but there were two big, not big games. And I'm talking actually quite early in the rain when I got really worried. One was Sheffield Wednesday away. We lost 5-1.
5-1, yeah.
And I remember going, I went up to Hillsborough. Yeah, it was a year that same. I thought I'm going to go. And I remember going thinking, crikey. And I think it was even a case of some of the players were playing in different positions. And I was getting a bit confused. And then the really big one was, and again, I'm not expecting you to remember all the games, sorry, but we played Fulham.
Fulham away. In the Cup, FA Cup, Damien
and
Francis.
And we played Damien
right
Francis at right back, or even might have been left back. And straight away, I was like, what the hell is going on? Like, it was like, oh my God, this is a car crash. We were all, and don't get me wrong, I know football fans all think they know what's best. And by the way, we still think we know what we're talking about. But it was just that Fulham game in the Cup. I remember being on the terrace with my dad and we turn up and, you know, it's FA Cup. I think it might be round 3, could have been round 4 maybe. I can't remember exactly.
They were League 2 at the time, weren't
they? I think Jean Tigana was manager potentially. And I was really excited about the game. And I remember turning up thinking, we're going to get absolutely slaughtered here. And we were played off the park. And Fulham were
3-0.
You know, it was the Al-Fayed era that it was just coming through. I'm just curious as to at what point, if you can remember, did your red flag or your little alarm bell go, hold on a minute, this isn't quite where we could be in a spot of bother here?
I think when we lost about a sixth game on the trot, I think that was...
that's always a good one mathematically, isn't it?
That was the sort of, Christ, this is, you know, we're going free fall. And once you're in free fall, it's difficult, particularly when you know the character of the players, when you know the character of the manager, that there was going to be no unless the players could grab it and claw it back, he wasn't going to be able to do it. So it was probably, I had my own job to do. You know, I was around the place, but concentrating on what I was doing. So I never really sort of, I'd watch training occasionally, but so never really sort of took a great interest until we started losing those amount of games on the trot, because it had never really happened before.
So, because we ain't got much time left here, I just want to go through a couple of big games before we go. And so Igor Olsen gets sacked. They've asked you to come in now and do the job, and you were like, all right, I'm off, meant to be going to Israel to do something, but yeah, I'll take it. What games did we had? Villa? What were the other games?
Villa,
Bradford
Villa
away.
Southampton.
Was that it? Was you? Because I remember it being really late.
Two games.
Was it just because one of the questions was Bradford away. Do you... So Igor Olsen was still in charge at Bradford and you were there. Is it true that Dean Blackwell knocked out John Hartson? Half time.
I'm not sure, yeah, that good a punch, really.
No, I don't think he did either.
Dino. There was a row. There was a row, and at Bradford, the changing rooms, you could, like, there were, you know, the width of a kitchen table.
Yeah.
And so there was, it all kicked off, and there was a few sort of punches thrown across the dressing room, but it wasn't anything unusual really at that period of football, and it often happened, and at least it showed that they had some heart and some bottle and some fight left.
Sorry, Dan.
But I can't, to be truthful, Lee, I can't really remember. I don't think he would have knocked him out. He might have hit him a glancing blow, but that's about it.
Because I'd still blame Jeff Winter for that day. I know Bradford battered us in the end, but we had a goal disallowed that should have been given. I think Yawley scores. I think we should have had a penalty, or their penalty was ridiculous as well. And I
Ben
still
Thatcher
blame,
got sent off, didn't Bev, he?
Yeah, and I just, and yeah, I think it was ridiculous, the Jeff Winter game. But yeah, and then Southampton, we end up scoring last minute. Do you think we could do it then?
You mean the Villa game? We scored against Villa, didn't we, last minute? And then,
yeah, 2-2.
Or
Bradford,
compare with Bradford's result, and Bradford had Liverpool, but Liverpool,
that's right,
you know, they were already, their flip flops on. They were on the beach, weren't they? I think they didn't have anything to play for, and Bradford ended up beating them comfortably on the day, and we, as history knows, sort of got beat at Southampton, who had a new manager come in, and Glenn Hoddle, So all the everything that you thought could not go against you, but that sort of would lead to the opposition really having to try, and Bradford really having an easier game than we had, which and they were at home as well. So yeah, it's it does still hurt those the aftermath of that.
When you look back, Terry, at managing Wimbledon, do you look back at it with pride? Do you look back at it with a tinge of sadness? Do you look back at it as a, do you know what, if X, Y, and Z, or I had a bit of this? How do you reflect? It's quite a, I'm a teacher and I've coached a lot of international cricket. So I've got a little bit, not as nowhere near as much as you, but you always look back and go, could I, should have, that was great. I'm just interested how you look back now at that time.
Yeah, I think reflection is massively important, and sometimes it hurts, you know, and you always think you could do things better. I'm proud that I got the opportunity to manage Wimbledon, and I think I'm the last manager to be the highest league position that they held, which was ninth in the championship, you know. So there's something there to grab onto. But of course, you always look at it and you think you could have done more. You could have changed things in certain games. I'm pleased that at the end that I kept to my principles, because you talked about the reason I got the sack. The main reason I got the sack was that they told me not to play Peter Hawkins. Charles Coppell told me not to play him in the last game of the season because he would get a rise in his contract if he reached that amount of games. This was about, like, you know, the week before the game. And I said, look, if I decide that he should be playing for football reasons, I'm going to play him. I'm not going to play him, not play him for financial reasons. I said, and this is not about me being clever. I said, it's about me doing what's right for the club. This is a kid that's come through the whole youth system. He's everything that Wimbledon's about. I said, and that dressing room will know, because I had another year of my contract still to go. I said, that dressing room will know that I'm not going to stand up for them when I need to stand up for them. I'm standing up for this player. I said, if I think he's the best player for the position on the day, I'm going to play him. And I'm not going to play him because of you've got to give him another £20 a week more. I said, that's absolutely ridiculous. I said, so, and he said, well, the owners will be onto you about it. And I said, well, let them call me. And then the owners called me 2 days later and I told them the same. I said, no. I said, look, if I think he's going to play, he's going to play. I said, and you're not going to pick the team and you're not going to tell me what players to play for any reason. So I'm.
He could have spoken to you before the Wickham FA Cup game, couldn't he? And then he wouldn't have missed that penalty. That'd have been handy.
the Wickham game, yeah.
Yeah, that was good, that one. That was quite a good cup tie.
It was about the player. It was about the principal.
Yeah.
And it could have been any one of them they might have said it about. And I would have gone, no, these are our kids. They've come through the ranks, you know, and this is what the club's built on. It's built on giving players, young players, an opportunity. And if they play and they deserve a chance, well, great, we'll play them. If they don't perform, we won't play them. And so, yeah, I guess from a pride point of view, I'm pleased that I stuck to my principles. Of course, you always look back and go, the what ifs and could have beens, but you can't beat yourself up over those things, and you just got to go. By and large, I'm you know, happy and proud of my time at Wimbledon and my contribution to the club over those 14 years. I look back at it as fond memories.
I'll say, if you look back, some of the money that Wimbledon brought in for some of them players kept us afloat pretty much, and over them years, and brought in the Ben Thatchers and brought in the Kenny Cunninghams and Duncan Jupps and things like that, that kept us going. So, yeah. Before we do wrap up, Terry, I was going to say, have you been down to Plough Lane yet? Have you been down and... because?
No, I've never got an invite. So I live in Chesterfield. I live in the north.
That's not your fault, Terry. Don't worry about it. We've all got problems, mate.
Somebody's got to. I obviously went to when they played, you know, when it was where Chelsea are using now. I went there a couple of times, but no, I've not actually been to the new stadium. No.
Right, an email is pending, don't worry.
Yeah, I was going to say, Danny McLean, or anyone who's still at the... Well, Danny McLean should be the man. If he's listening, get in contact. We'll give you Terry's number. If that's all right, Terry, give you a number, and then we'll get you down to play alone. Because, as I said, 14 years of service, some of the players you brought through, some of the as I said, me and Danny, I was like a fanboy when I've got to say thank you to Brett Neil for giving me your number to get you on. But yeah, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you, and I'd love to see you down at Plough Lane and getting the plaudits that you deserve from the fans that were there for the 14 years that you were there, and the new fans that you know what I mean?
That have come along since. I keep an eye on, and it's, you know, a few clubs have on my list now that I look for and results, and some of them, you know, for me are more important than others, but AFC would be up there along with the Arsenal and the results that I look for.
Well, Terry, thanks for coming on. Genuinely, your impact on our lives in terms of, you know, I've supported Wimbledon since I was a little boy, and the times I share dearly. We talk a lot about, you know, I go to watch football, frankly, because I love spending time with my dad. And my dad, remember, took me to Plough Lane when I was a kid and pushed everyone to the side and pushed me at the front. And that was when you started. And the fact of the crazy gang growing up at school, being the underdog, never giving up, standing up for yourself, and it's okay to be different. Some of those stories and the messaging has allowed me to continue supporting Wimbledon, and some of the, not to be too soppy here, but some of the traits of being a Wimbledon fan have held me in such an amazing stead. And that is partly down to your dedication, your expertise. And yeah, we absolutely loved what you did for the club. And hand on heart, I'm just thankful that you were there. And thank you very much for all that you did for us. Thanks. You gave us the ride of a life, and we are desperately, desperately delighted and over the moon that you gave it to us. So thank you ever so much.
Really appreciate that, Danny. Thank you.
Yeah, I just echo what Danny said. Like, some of the players I fell in love with, and yeah, they come for our youth, and that's all due to what you did, Terry, and the way you coached them. So yeah, again, I can't thank you enough for the 14 years you gave to us, and I really appreciate it coming on and keep telling us a tale. And I think a lot of Wimbledon fans will be listening and happy that you came on and spoke to us.
Yeah, no, it's been a pleasure, and it was a great time in my life. I loved it, and look back at it with fond memories. So thank you.
Terry Bowen,
Terry, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very
much. Cheers, guys. Take care.
Take care now. Thank you. So when we come back, we'll discuss, me and Danny will preview Doncaster away on Saturday. But yeah, that was just amazing. But yeah, when we come back, we'll discuss Doncaster away.
The Wombles Had a Dream podcast, by the fans, for the fans.
We're back. We're going to be discussing Doncaster on Saturday, but I think me and Danny are still buzzing from speaking to Terry
Burton. I'm not being funny. Literally, well done to Brett, and well done to you for getting him, because as we said at the end of the interview, just some of the stories and some of the most wonderful memories I share with friends of mine who will be listening to this, and friends who hopefully will be with me for the rest of my life, and my dad. It's just quite odd having a bloke who basically gave you their memories, if that makes sense. And I use Wimbledon a lot in job interviews and stuff because of what they stand for, and being different and multicultural and all this sort of stuff, and all the things that we don't even think about. It was also exactly what I thought it was when I was younger. Joe Kinnear was the brash bloke, chatting to the guys, motivating them. Terry Burton was behind putting the cones out and getting everything ready. Yeah, it was almost exactly like that.
If you look at Wimbledon, that's very Wimbledon-ish. There's a lot of Wimbledon fans with Brett. You know what I mean? Me and you probably wouldn't get along if it weren't for Wimbledon. You know what I mean? Like, if we met in a pub, because you're quite a smart guy, I'm very brash. Do you know what I mean? But it kind of works when you're at Wimbledon. Yeah. I go to Wimbledon with a guy I went to Milan with, very intelligent man, Al. Do you know what I mean? He got me this, like, thick as two planks. And then we're discussing football, and it just works. You sitting there, you talk about Wimbledon. And yeah, just Terry, as I said, it blows my mind that we've got these crazy gang days, these mad people that burnt suits and stuff. But then when you speak to them, they're softly spoken, they're the intelligent, they're really
and
nice.
That is the thing with, and that what you said earlier was perfect, is that Wimbledon was seen as this brainless, smash it, bundle people, and Terry Burton is like this football academic with Don Howe, who was one of the top. We're not Mickey Mouse stuff, we're talking about best in world, not best in Europe. And that behind that, hoofing it, Terry Burton, as the attention to detail, the strategy, was stunning. But yeah,
used to wind me up when Gary Lineker said he'd rather watch Teletex, and the press would give us a bad time just being a long ball merchant team, which was totally false. We wasn't. We played in a way that it suited us. We got the ball forward quickly and we played to our strengths, where we'd rather have it in your final third than ours. And I just used to wind me up. And when I started watching Wimbledon, I just fell in love with everything about it. And yeah, it was just great to speak to him. And
more importantly, have to get him to the ground. Like you were speaking always about old guys coming down. Having Terry Burton, I can imagine having Terry Burton joking.
Again,
in
I didn't
down.
Realize.
Stunning.
I didn't realize he was there 14 years. I thought he was there for a long time, but not 14 years. From 88 all the way through to pretty much when we got relegated.
After this, we need to extend it. I'm sure there isn't a single Wimbledon fan who was around before AFC would not welcome Terry Burton at the club.
Oh, 100%. As I said,
when
I told the lads I was speaking to him, one of them's like, Mr. You know, when we say Joe Kinnear was Mr. Wimbledon,
yeah.
Terry Burton was, again, another Mr. Wimbledon, do you know what I mean? Who loved it. He said it himself. He loved being at Wimbledon. He loved bringing in the Joe McInnes, the Pat Dragonmans, who were not, you know, where I feel bad now, though. I feel Mark Robinson could have been that man for us.
Of course.
Unfortunately, football had moved on too much.
I think the key thing, though, Lee, is he has been, but he's just not, he's in a different way.
Yeah,
and obviously,
you know what I mean?
Give it 10 years. Don't get me wrong, at the time when Terry Burton's probably leaves, I'm not sure Wimbledon fans might want to maybe want to change, or maybe things are different. And Robbo will get that praise later on in his career.
They're very similar, kind of.
It was also interesting.
With the philosophies and stuff.
But even Terry Burton, like, was remembering old players like Ansara Owusu or Aggie Mang. He's worked with thousands of players, Lee. Thousands. And the people who were really
Ian
not
Hazel
were,
and stuff
like
that.
Literally, these are all people who Wimbledon fans have, you know, not just set up worldwide, just good for us. It was
shame we couldn't get him on for hours, because he said he only had an hour, which is perfect, brilliant. I could have spoke to him for the rest of the night, really, about some of the players and some of the stories and stuff. And we probably only got 50% of what people wanted to listen to, but unfortunately, that is the case with podcasts.
But you know what? That you know, there's always opportunities in the future to have him on. And well done to everybody.
I said, Danny Macklin, if you do listen this week, please contact me regarding Terry's number. I'll pass it over, and please invite him down. Please get him in the suite. Do you know what I mean? Or get him down for hospitality. He should not pay for a ticket. Shouldn't pay for anything, that man. Because they're talking about the Hall of Fame, ain't they, and stuff like that. Now, Terry Burton's name should be in that. I don't think because he was in the background doing the reserves, the youth and people, things like that. Yeah, I don't think he probably got the credit that he deserved at the time, even with some of the players that we bought through, we end up selling for millions. We end up buying Kimballs, do you know what I mean? The Thatchers, the Cunninghams.
Warren Bartons,
Do you know what I mean? And stuff like that. And we bought them for cheap, and then we made them better players and sold them on for millions. So, yeah. Anyway,
We've gone from the past. Let's talk about now. So, obviously, Saturday was disappointing. We won't go into that too much, but there was quite an interesting point in the ground where, you know, I don't know if you've read about this yet, but all of the flags were taken down. The general got the ump and basically just took them all down. I don't know whether it was for whatever reason, but the fans kind of gathered. It was like a protest about I've had enough, which I didn't really read it as that. It seemed like quite a kind of like, not like a monumental, but quite a big moment, because it was kind of felt like the moment that like fans were starting to turn a little bit on the team in terms of the way they were playing. And I don't think they were particularly poor, but the last half an hour was pretty desperate, and obviously we just kind of almost surrendered it in the end, which was a shame. But moving on to Doncaster, we've got to find a way to stop the rot. We've got to find a way to score some goals. Ali Alhamadi has been excellent.
He was
excellent on Saturday. And we need to find a way now of stopping the rot one end and scoring some goals in the other. Because as I said to you before, it doesn't take long before people start questioning. And already we're now talking about, we're almost in a dead rubber situation, really. Who's going to be around? Who's going to be at the helm? And I feel like we really, really, really need to stop the rot. And I feel like Saturday, on paper, is probably one of those games where it really could. We're playing Doncaster. I don't think there's a lot.
They're
in
horrendous form as well.
I mean, Doncaster and us are pretty much... Doncaster are hanging on to playoff thoughts by a thread. We're well out of it. So it's kind of a a game of two dead rubbers, I feel like whatever we do, we're not going to make up 14 points and get into the playoffs. We're completely toast for that. And relegation wise, we're bizarrely 16 points off bottom two, so we're totally in the middle. And I think I can't imagine for any stretch of the imagination we'll be put in either way. But I do think it is quite a big game for the manager, and I do think it's a really, really big game for the players, because all of a sudden losing two away games on the spin, that will then all of a sudden create the Crawley game at home being an absolute must win. So I think it's a big game for a few individuals. But what are your thoughts on it at the moment?
I think it's a massive game for the manager. I really do. I really think it's big, because the shouts now are turning again.
We've won what, once in the whole calendar year?
Yeah, and some of his selections are baffling. Some of the formations are baffling. Ali is scoring goals, which is strange to me, considering now we're putting him up front. He's scoring. Do you know what I mean? We said it before. If you put him up front, he'll score goals. He is doing it. People are going, oh, he's rubbish. Do you know what I mean? He's playing on a wing. He's never played on the wing at Wickham. He's never played on the wing before that. Play him up front, he scores goals. Josh Davison looks beaten up, looks done in, looks dead. Pell, I think he's out. As I said, I think he's out long-term, but we haven't been told how long that's going to be. I just think a lot of our players look done in. Woodyard still looks done in.
Yeah.
I don't think I can't really talk about the weekend's game. I haven't watched anything. I've only seen some of the goals, and I think Nick Zanev needs to wake up, or he could be gone in the summer, because apparently it was shocking on Saturday. And as I said, the goals I've seen, what's with the one where he comes running out and then misses the header?
Yeah.
that's amateur stuff. But I think it's a massive game for Johnny Jackson. Because the summer's huge for him, and people keep saying you can't sack a manager, you got to give him another window and stuff. But do you know what I mean? He's had, you could really say it's been two seasons in one. Do you know what I mean? You lost Taylor, you lost Assal, you then had January to kind of rebuild it a bit, and we've been on dire form since. Doncaster are not on great form. They lost to Harrogate, they drew with someone, then they lost Bradford and Sutton. So they haven't won, but they're at home.
Do you feel like we've been playing poorly in the last? Because I feel like our results aren't great, but I don't feel we're playing horrendous. Like I said, Saturday, the first half, we were pinging it about. We looked brilliant in the first half, Lee. Honestly, we were buzzing, moving around, lots of interpasses. We scored a goal. I thought we looked really, really good at the start. We just haven't been able to transition, losing that extra man in midfield. We've just not been able to do it.
I think it's tiredness. I think a lot of our players look tired. They look beaten up. Injuries are taking their toll now on us, which we said before, why we got so many injuries. I don't know if we have got a physio yet or not. I think that isn't helping. Pierre, I don't know why he's been brought in, because Will Nightingale has been injured for half the season, gets brought back in. We start conceding goals again at the back because we're having to mix it up all the time. Do you know what I mean? We've got lucky enough a goal scorer who can score, but the other one's now gone to sleep, and he needs a rest. But who'd you bring back? Yeah. The Zach Robinson stuff's all baffling to me as well, where you've got a goal scorer there and he's scoring goals. Do you know what I mean? That you could be bringing on or putting up front, starting games with Ali, and he isn't. Yeah, I think it's a massive game for Johnny Jackson. For me, it just feels like with his statements after games and stuff, he seems very arrogant that he's untouchable. The Oxford stuff was quite, everyone was getting excited about him going to Oxford. So that, I think that shows where the fans are with him at the moment. And as we said before, a lot of people are still not really in love with him kind of thing, and still not got that relationship with him. I don't know what you've mentioned regarding the flag stuff. I don't know how that's a protest, taking our flags down. Do you know what I mean? Not going to games, I think, is a bigger protest, which a lot of people are doing now as well. I don't think we're going to be taking many up to Doncaster. I think we're going to really struggle to get fans up to Barrow in a couple of weeks. If you look at the prices, I think it was 130 quid to get to Barrow.
130?
Yeah. Yeah, oh, Matt, and they only went on sale today. Harrogate's not cheap either. So I think people were looking at it and think, I'm not going to bother. I said, I know most people may be aware that I went away the weekend to Italy. If you're not, you know what I mean? Where have you been?
We heard it somewhere.
But I spent 150 quid on flights, hotel, and two match tickets. Do you know what I mean? For two games. I know I spent a bit
more. And we're talking about Serie A here, aren't we?
Yeah, we're talking about San Siro, Milan. Do you know what I mean? And this is what I've said before. The price in this country is just joke. Trains, match tickets. It has to be looked at, and hopefully will be. But yeah, what's your score predictions?
I think we'll get something out of the game. I think we need to get something out of the game. And I think that two poor teams being together, I'm going to say a draw. I think we'll get a 1-1. I think Al Hamadi continues the goal scoring, but I think the starting lineup and the way that we play is going to be fascinating in terms of how we try to recover. I think it's also going to be, I think it is important to note though, from a fan point of view, that this is very new ground for us. We've always been every game. We need to fight for something. We're now at a point where frankly, it doesn't really matter because the season's kind of dead. But I think it's just trying to find reasons to keep it alive. And I think some players in particular, it's a really important 10 games, as you said, for the manager. And I think that momentum going into the summer could be the difference between players staying, players going, managers coming, managers going. So I'm going to say 1-1. I think Al Hamadi scores again. I think he's looked exceptional. But I still don't quite think we've got enough at the back yet to keep it going. And it's been a frustrating season of not sure who's going to play where, what's the right formation, what's the right personnel. So I'll say 1-1. And then I think we'll go into Newport and, yeah, we'll see where we are. So a 1-1 would be a good way to sort of stop the rot. But like you said, it would be lovely to sort of turn the tide a little bit. Not necessarily results, but like results would be handy, but the way that we play, I think, would be handy. 1-1.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think it's either going to be 1-1 or, unfortunately, we're going to lose 2-1. I just can't see us not scoring, conceding goals at the moment, which is mad considering a few weeks ago we were such a tight-knit ship. But yeah, I just don't have any... I'm kind of done with the season, Dan, which is, again, I know everyone wanted a mid-table finish and stuff, but we're sinking like a stone and we could end up finishing 15th or 18th and stuff, which at the end of the season, wherever we finish, I think questions are going to be asked if we finish 15th or below or even 13th and below. But yeah, I think I just can't get up for it. I don't really care at the moment. Do you know what I mean? I prefer talking to people like Terry Burton about the old days and, do you know what I mean? And that, but yeah, I think 1-1 or 2-1, but yeah, that's it really. Right, we ready? Is that it, Dan? Because what I want to say quickly is a big thank you to Jack Maltney, who held the Sunday debrief while I was away. Apparently done a great job, so thanks to Jack. Hopefully he'll be able to hold a few more if I'm away again. And yeah, thanks to you, Danny, for coming on again, and thanks to speaking to Terry Byrne.
Well done, mate. Top work. Thanks, everybody. And thanks for listening.
Yep, and thanks to Season Master, our sponsors, Gary Fletcher and the lads, massive Wimbledon fans, Secondary Glazing, Bifold Doors, hit them up, they're all our socials and our graphics, and yeah, come on you dons.
Go you and boos.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Wombles Had a Dream podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Wombles Dream and on Facebook at the Wombles Had a Dream. Get involved. By the fans, for the fans.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.